This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Our occasional series on the do-it-yourself movement has touched on everything from solar backpacks to bamboo bikes. Coming up, we'll add music to that list and talk with a do-it-yourself rocker. But now, the first of two stories on DIY hackers. As John Kalish reports, they're not the kind who break into computer networks. The DIY hackers modify everyday items to serve new purposes and workspaces to serve hackers.
In a farm field 60 miles east of its home base in San Francisco, seven members of the Noisebridge Hackerspace launch an amateur weather balloon that rises 70,000 feet in the atmosphere.
All right, 3, 2, 1.
In Chicago, members of the Pumping Station 1 Hackerspace modify a bicycle and trailer to make glow-in-the-dark ice cream. And in Ann Arbor, Michigan, at the All Hands Active Hackerspace, a young woman with a degree in neuroscience but no job at the moment uses a grinder on an empty propane tank she's turning into a drum. In hackerspaces all over North America, do-it-yourselfers are drilling, gluing, soldering, and welding just about anything you can imagine. There are now more than 70 hackerspaces in the U.S. and Canada, with dozens more planned or in the process of being formed. Many cities have more than one. Often hackerspaces consist of nothing more than a large room where DIYers share tools and expertise, but others are equipped with expensive computer-controlled power tools. While the focus at some hackerspaces is primarily on electronics, at others sawdust flies and sewing machines whir. And there's a lot of learning going on at hackerspaces, be it a beer brewing workshop, a lockpicking seminar, or a demo of an egg bot, which draws pictures on eggs. At the Brooklyn Hackerspace NYC Resistor, a visitor from Brazil recently gave a talk about building his own pinball machine. The hackers at NYC Resistor have some experience of their own with recreational machinery. They took an old slot machine and turned it into a robot that mixes alcoholic drinks, from Bloody Marys to Dirty Chihuahuas. Bree Pettis is co-founder of NYC Resistor.
NYC Resistor is a force of chaos in the world. Imagine kittens with jetpacks flying around in a room.
All of this energy and creativity is made possible by a well-equipped and stable place to work, which is what these hacker spaces are. They wouldn't survive without some financial support, so most have monthly dues between $50 and $100. A handful are commercial enterprises, but most are nonprofit and are run democratically. Mitch Altman is co-founder of the San Francisco hackerspace Noisebridge.
It's a combination of community as well as opportunities for people to express themselves through making things and learning more and more about what they're enthusiastic about and really love. Each space is unique. And over time, all of the spaces do get more diverse.
Such diversity is evident at the Philadelphia hackerspace Hive 76. On a recent weeknight, one member was making business cards by etching beef jerky with a laser cutter. Another member played his iPod through a small suitcase that had been transformed into a boombox. And a 26-year-old electrical engineer named Jack Zilkin mashed new technology with old by making a computer keyboard out of an old manual typewriter.
So I'm writing you an email right now, and it's pretty much just the same as writing a regular email.
Before he started wiring up old manual typewriters, Zilkin made wooden puzzles at home. He used his bedroom as a silkscreen studio. His kitchen did double duty as a woodshop.
Before I came here to Hive 76, I had a drill press right next to my sink, so that I'd be drilling a hole in something with the drill press, and then all the wood shavings I had just like brushed into the sink trap. And then this place like rescued me and just gave me a place to put all my tools, meet other crazy people who were also at risk of burning their houses down.
There are lots of driven people like Jack Zilkin tinkering all over the country. Hackerspaces are making it possible, and in some cases profitable, for them to pursue their creative impulses and to make things no one has even imagined. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish.
Our series continues next week with the story about innovators who have used DIY hacker spaces to start unusual small businesses, like converting manual typewriters into computer keyboards and creating business cards out of beef jerky.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skeep. The recent midterm elections could affect the future of the Internet. Democrats in Congress, along with the Federal Communications Commission, had been crafting rules to protect what they call a free and open Internet. But Republicans say the Internet isn't broken, doesn't need fixing. Now, with Republicans about to gain control of the House, advocates of new rules for an open Internet are pinning their fading hopes on the FCC. Joel Rose reports.
If the debate over how to regulate broadband Internet access strikes you as dry, you're not alone. But the next chapter may get a little rowdier.
Does the FCC say we're going to figure out a way to hammer out a compromise, or do they say we're putting the monster truck in drive?
That was Bruce Melman, a lobbyist for the telecommunications industry and possibly the first person to ever compare the Federal Communications Commission to a monster truck. Okay, let's throw it in reverse for a minute. Technology companies and public interest groups want to see more regulation of broadband internet access to ensure a level playing field for all websites and applications, an idea known by the decidedly unrowdy phrase net neutrality. Gigi Sohn is the president of Public Knowledge, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit.
The public wants an internet where they are in control of what services they can access and what websites they can access.
But the phone and cable companies that actually provide that access, they say the market is working fine and we don't need more rules. Again, telecom industry lobbyist Bruce Melman.
Without a heavy regulatory framework in place, with the marketplace being the marketplace, we've had 10 years of incredible success in broadband and broadband applications and content. What's the problem that we need to regulate to fix?
Well, there is the time Comcast was caught trying to block its users from sharing large files. The cable giant says it was just trying to manage traffic. Consumer advocates say it was throttling competition. But when the FCC tried to discipline Comcast, it lost in court, leaving the agency's authority over broadband providers up in the air. Democrat Henry Waxman, the chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, tried to negotiate a net neutrality bill before the midterm election. Here's what he said at the time.
We have spent a great deal of time with the carriers, the telephone and cable companies, with the consumer groups, with the high-tech groups. I think we developed as close a consensus as we possibly could, but the Republicans decided they didn't want to be part of this effort.
Waxman hasn't said whether he'll try to revive the bill during the current lame duck session, but Republicans who are poised to take control of the committee, including Cliff Stearns of Florida, are urging him not to.
Many of us think that that's the wrong avenue to present any kind of substantive issue like that in a lame duck, so I would urge Mr. Waxman not to offer net neutrality.
That leaves advocates of a free and open internet, like Gigi Sohn, to make the case for more regulation at the Federal Communications Commission.
It's become eminently clear that if net neutrality is going to get done, and I believe that this FCC chairman wants it to get done, it has to be done in his house.
FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski declined to be interviewed for this story. If Genachowski does push for net neutrality now, if he decides to throw the monster truck in drive, he'll get plenty of opposition from congressional Republicans like Cliff Stearns.
I think it's a bad idea to let them do it unilaterally. I think Congress has a jurisdiction.
But the FCC chairman may disagree. Whatever happens, it's a given that he will face tough questioning on Capitol Hill. And it's conceivable that Republicans would try to block funding for his agenda. But Gigi Sohn at Public Knowledge thinks it's not too late for Genachowski to get behind the wheel.
Chairman Genachowski came to the FCC saying, I'm all about consumers, I'm all about what the consumer wants. It's time for him to act on that promise.
On the campaign trail, candidate Barack Obama pledged his support for net neutrality. If the FCC is going to make good on that promise, it may have to drive over a big pile of Republican obstacles. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Blogg. Now a story about internet hijacking. On April 8th, a massive amount of global internet traffic was routed through China for at least 18 minutes. That hijacking affected traffic from and to U.S. government and military sites, as well as commercial websites including Microsoft and IBM. That finding was revealed yesterday in a report from a congressionally appointed panel, the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. Well, today, China Telecom denied hijacking internet traffic. We're going to sort out what this means with Dmitry Alperovich. He is the vice president of threat research for the cybersecurity firm McAfee. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
And what happened on April 8th exactly?
Well, what happened is that about 15% of the world's destinations on the internet, an enormous amount of traffic, was redirected through China. So it's very much like if you're sending a letter from, let's say, Washington, D.C. to London, you would give it to the U.S. Postal Service, and they would know implicitly that the way to get to London is to pass it on to the U.K. Royal Mail, and they'll deliver it within the U.K. Let's assume that, let's pick on Fiji, that they come to the U.S. Postal Service and announce that they are actually responsible for all letters being routed to London, and let's assume that U.S. Postal Service will just believe that implicitly because that's how the internet works. So the way it happens is that China Telecom, a state-owned internet service provider in China, basically announced to the rest of the world that they're the owners of the networks of 15% of the internet. So networks included Office of the Secretary of Defense, all of the armed services, a number of intelligence networks, a number of civilian government networks as well. Up to 172 countries were actually impacted by this hijack.
Now, we're calling it a hijacking. The panel called it a hijacking. We should say China Telecom says there was no hijacking. How do you explain that?
Well, the hijacking is actually a technical term, so it just means that the traffic was rerouted through China. So that's sort of an undisputable fact that was observed by many people around the world. Whether it was intentional or not is, of course, a point of some debate. It's impossible to prove it without some information being provided by China Telecom, but it's just a lot of things are unknown at this point.
If there were malicious intent with something like this, theoretically, what could happen with hijacked data? What would the security risk be?
Well, the security risk is quite significant. Certainly, all this data could have been eavesdropped on and wiretapped. It could have been also modified in flight, and the recipient of that data could have been presented with something totally different. Also, a lot of the what are known as VPNs, virtual private networks, traverse the internet and are encrypted with these mechanisms that can be broken. You can indeed gain access to private networks of organizations through this hijacking method.
Is there any way to prevent a hijacking like apparently what happened on April 8th?
There is really no way to do this right now without a massive re-architecture of the internet. In fact, Vint Cerf, who is known as the father of the internet and the inventor of many of these fundamental building blocks, likes to say that the internet was an experiment that never ended. And when it was built, it was really not built with security in mind. So to fix these fundamental issues, you really have to re-engineer how the internet works. And that's something that would take decades and enormous investments to achieve.
Okay. Well, Dmitry Alperovich, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much.
Dmitry Alperovich is vice president of threat research for the cybersecurity firm McAfee.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Last week, we told you about an ambitious plan called the Simultanea Project. This week, the results. If you heard artist Erin Cooney explain her concept, you'll remember that it was to create a coordinated one-minute snapshot of the world on video.
Well, on Saturday, several hundred participants shot footage at precisely the same moment. Erin Cooney returns now to tell us how it all went. And I want you to remind us first why you encouraged people to do this.
I encourage people to do it basically because I want to see 1 minute played back from as many points of view as I can. It's kind of an attempt to have an out-of-body experience, if you will.
And how many videos did you get?
I've received more than 300 so far.
And you have an audio clip made from all of this footage. What are we about to hear?
You're about to hear audio from 18 different locations from around the world, ranging from Alaska, Thailand, London, Kentucky, New York, Slovenia, Montana, and Arizona, and a couple more.
Okay, let's roll it.
9 o'clock.
We've started. We are in Denali National Park, Alaska.
Artists are going to put it together and make it a project.
State in the United States.
Yeah!
Yeah!
I'm going.
Saturday.
Oh, we're still going.
Our conversation.
Wow. That was terrific. How many places was that from?
That was for a total of 18 places. We were hearing crickets from Thailand. We were even hearing the view from backstage on a Slovenian television show, believe it or not.
I knew that's where that was. No, I'm only kidding.
Of course. Wind chimes in Kentucky. We were hearing a woman in Alaska telling us that it was still nighttime in Alaska. I want people to understand that what they're hearing really was happening in time, just as you hear it. What you hear at Senkent 20 is what was actually taking place at Senkent 20 during the 1 minute moment from all over the world.
In all those different places around
that's
the world.
That's right.
When will the video version be ready and where can people see it?
Well, I've got a lot of work cut out for me now. It's going to take me many months to produce this. I'm thinking April, spring 2011, and people will be able to see it on my website at simultaneaproject.com as well as streamingmuseum.org. And it's going to play with Streaming Museum, an organization in New York, who have partners around the world, and they have screens in public places and plazas in different cities throughout the world. And it will be shown there as well as in Los Angeles.
Is there anything you've seen or heard in all of these videos that has really surprised you about what was going on at that one particular minute on Earth last Saturday?
You know, I have to say I was thinking I was going to get some really surprising, shocking videos. I haven't received one of those yet, and that's probably a good thing. No, it's really what I asked for. It's a slice of life. You know, I'm seeing people in cars and on their bikes, on motorcycles. I've got a guy who's filmed his point of view while he's on a plane cross-country. The thing that is amazing for me during this editing process is to sit down and go through all these submissions, which I still haven't gone through all of them. There's so many. But to see all of these things happening during this 1 minute, it's magical, and I cannot wait to have people be able to see that too.
Well, Erin Cooney, thank you very much for talking with us once again about your Simultanea project.
Robert, thank you so much for having me on.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Lots of talk this week about public resistance to the new full-body scanning machines at the airports. The full-body scan, which penetrates your clothes, showing great detail, is done using one of two different machines. There's one machine that uses millimeter waves. It's a millimeter wave machine, and there's another one that uses X-rays. And it's the latter that have radiation experts buzzing because they subject passengers to what the TSA and the FDA say is a minuscule amount of ionizing radiation. But just because it's a small amount, does that mean it's safe? And how do scientists know what a safe dose of radiation is? In addition, some TSA workers are exposed to small amounts of radiation that may leak or escape the baggage X-ray machines. How much of a risk do they face from accumulated radiation exposure? Joining me to talk about it is my guest, David J. Brenner, is the Higgins Professor of Radiation Biophysics at Columbia University. He's also director of the Center for Radiological Research there, and that's the oldest and largest radiological research center in the country. It was founded by a student of Marie Curie. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Brenner.
Pleasure to be here, Ira.
Yeah, thank you. Let's talk about the machines that scan the people. There are two basic types, right?
Yes, there are. One is usually called millimeter wave scan machine, and the other is called X-ray backscatter machine. In fact, they both work on the same basic principle of firing a beam of radiation at the individual and looking at what gets reflected back, quite similar to radar or sonar, but in one case using millimeter waves, which are not so different from microwaves, in fact, and the other uses X-rays.
Mm-hmm. And it's the backscatter X-ray machines that give you a dose of X-ray radiation.
That's correct. As far as we know, one can never say something is safe, but as far as we know, there is no health hazard associated with the millimeter wave scanners. So the concern is more about the X-ray scanners.
Mm-hmm. And what is that concern?
Well, we know that X-rays can damage DNA in cells, and we know that X-rays can ultimately produce cancer. So the concern is about the possibility of inducing X-ray-induced cancer in one of the individuals who scanned.
Mm-hmm. On their website, the FDA says that these X-ray machines, quote, deliver an extremely low dose of radiation to the person being screened. The radiation is so low that there's no need to limit the number of individuals screened, or in most cases, the number of screening an individual can have in a year.
Well, I certainly agree with the first part of that statement. The radiation doses we're talking about here are exceedingly low. I think there's some evidence they're a little bit higher than the TSA are stating. But even then, the dose is still very low. And what that means is that the risk is extremely low for any individual going once through one of the scanners. Mm-hmm. The concerns we have are actually twofold. One is that there are actually a lot of people who go through airport security many times. One group, of course, is airline pilots. Another group is frequent flyers. A typical commercial airline pilot in this country goes through security anywhere from 200 to 400 times a year. So that means that the very small risk from an individual scan is multiplied by that number two or 300 times for a pilot or for a frequent flyer. In fact, there's certainly frequent flyers who go through security that many times in a year.
Or a flight attendant.
Or flight attendants, indeed.
I was talking to one on the plane the other day about this, and I asked her if she was fearful, and she said, "You know, I've been a flight attendant for 40 years." She said, just being up here at 35,000 feet for 6 hours at a time, I get plenty of radiation alone from just being that far above the Earth, and the pilots do also. And you know, I'm the last person that wants to walk through one of these machines.
Well, I would agree with that. And you could argue that the radiation that pilots and the rest of the air personnel get from natural sources is inevitable. There's nothing you can do about that. But the radiation from these scans, certainly one could avoid if one used, for example, the millimeter wave scanners, which don't involve X-rays at all.
Well, why don't we just use those then? Why not use the do away with the X-ray scanners and just use the millimeter ones, and everybody might feel better?
I certainly would. It's hard to know what the logic is. I mean, I think the logic must be that the TSA believes both of them are safe, and so they're using both of these devices. But there is certainly not conclusive evidence, but convincing evidence that there will be some cancers induced sometime in the future by these X-ray devices. Mm-hmm. The issue, Ira, is even though the individual risk is very small, we also think, when we think about risk, in terms of the population risk, that's the risk we've factored in, the number of people exposed to that risk. And what's happened in the in this field is until 2010, these machines were used actually quite rarely. They were not first-line screening devices. They were used for random checks and for people that there was some special interest in. But after the Christmas Day bombing of last year, the so-called underwear bomber, the TSA changed their policy and decided to use these devices as a frontline screening device, essentially, ideally, for everybody. Mm-hmm. So what that meant is that the number of people being scanned has gone up, or is going to go up quite dramatically. You know, the number of people going through airports at the moment is something like 750 million per year in the U.S. That's a big number. So imagine all of those people getting scanned. So we have a small risk, but we have an awful lot of people exposed to that small risk, and that gives you a public health concern as well as a concern for the individuals.
Have independent labs verified that these scanning machines are giving the low-level radiation that the TSA says they are?
Well, the answer is no. It would be good, and I think this really should happen, that these machines become available for the general scientific community to actually assess what the radiation doses actually are. At the moment, people are having to do it in a rather indirect way. You look at the images, the pictures that you've probably seen on the internet of from these devices, and you can work backwards from the quality of the image to how much radiation dose was actually produced, but needed to generate that image. Mm-hmm. And it's actually rather larger than the TSA's numbers. But what we really need is some independent measurements.
So you suspect that those numbers may be higher because the picture is so good?
Well, because the picture is moderately good, I would say. Uh-huh. And even if they're higher, the doses are still very low. That I think one must say. But they're probably somewhat higher than the TSA's estimates at this point.
Let's talk a bit in a couple of minutes we have left about the baggage handlers, because they stay by those baggage machines. And there was a study that came out in 2008 that sort of flew under the radar screen, I think, of anybody's attention. It was a study by NIOSH, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, at the request of the TSA to determine the level of radiation emissions from these systems that scan the baggage. And they had some very disquieting conclusions about what they found.
Yeah, indeed. They found that the handlers were actually getting a radiation exposure that we didn't expect, in part because they were reaching into the machines. That really shouldn't have happened, and it indicates some failure in terms of the quality control of the whole system.
Well, so shouldn't the TSA workers be wearing badges everywhere you go that people are around radiation, in hospitals and clinics? Your dentist wears a badge to see what their cumulative exposure is.
Absolutely. I work at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital here, and everybody associated with radiation work wears a film badge, and it's easy and it's inexpensive, and so every month there is a reading of how much radiation exposure anyone wearing the film badge gets. And it would sound an alarm if there are any possible overexposures. So it's a no-brainer in many ways for the folks associated with these devices to wear film badges.
Mm-hmm. Yet they tell us from personal communications that they're afraid or discouraged from wearing them. It's not against the rules, but they're told, you know, that has to be out of sight, some people have said.
Yeah, that's a little surprising. I mean, the film badges have to be organized by the employers, because the film badges then have to be sent off to be read and analyzed. So it's not something you can really do on a individual personal basis. It's something that the employers have to organize. Mm-hmm.
And so we don't know, even after this report came out, we don't know if any practices have changed.
I certainly haven't seen film badges on personnel in airports. I don't know if you have.
No, as I say, when I don't see them, I ask them and I ask why. And some people know about it, some people don't know about it. And you get some of the answers from when I go through there and I say, are you fearful of the machine? Are you getting any exposure? And many of them tell you, oh, I'm getting a little bit, but it's not harmful.
Well, small amount, very low dose of radiation on an individual basis probably are not so harmful, but radiation is cumulative. It builds up over time. And if a large population of people are being exposed to radiation, that's also a problem.
Mm-hmm. And so as far as the personal scanning and the choice between these two machines, one, if we did away with the x-rays, people might not worry about any x-ray radiation because there is a technology to use the millimeter one.
Yeah,
that's not.
I think that's true.
Is there any sonic kind of ultrasound scanner that they might develop?
Ultrasound has not proved very successful. It has been tried, in fact. It doesn't seem to have worked very well.
Yeah.
The two devices that seem to give the best images are the x-ray and the millimeter wave scanners, although it must be said there are lots of people working on different and newer technologies right now.
Well, thank you, Dr. Brenner, for taking time to be with us.
A pleasure.
I should point out to you and our listeners that we did invite the TSA to come on and talk about it, but they have declined to take us up on our invitation. David J. Brenner is the Higgins Professor of Radiation Biophysics at Columbia, and he is also the director of the Center for Radiological Research there, and that's interesting to note. That's the, as I say, the oldest radiology center in the country, founded by a student of Marie Curie. We're going to take a break and come back and change gears and talk about the music. How every time you listen to music or play an instrument, you're doing a little physics experiment. Why does a note make a certain sound and a hammer hitting a nail make a different one? There's physics behind all of this and how you listen to music. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Up next, On the Trail of the Elusive Antimatter.
We have a signal on the luminosity monitors. We have events.
Remember that scene from Angels and Demons? It showed scientists at CERN running experiments with the Large Hadron Collider and capturing antimatter in a bottle. Well, this week, scientists at CERN, real scientists and not the movie variety, announced the same thing, almost. They say they have finally produced and captured antimatter, antihydrogen, exactly, long enough to study it. Not a very long time, though. It's about a second, but it doesn't last long enough to be captured in a vial like in the movie, so they didn't get that part down yet. Here to tell us how they did it and what the physicists hope to learn from this antihydrogen is my guest, Jeffrey Hengst. He's professor in the Department of Astronomy and Physics at Aarhus University in Denmark. And he joins us from Switzerland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much, although I think it's going to be hard to follow that oboe stuff.
You mean antimatter is not sexy enough to follow an oboe made out of a straw? I think it is. How were you able to capture antimatter?
Okay, we have kind of a magnetic trap. Antihydrogen is neutral, so it has no net charge. So you can't trap it the way we normally trap charged particles. But it has a little magnetic character, like a little compass needle that flies around with the atom. So it can be deflected by very strong magnetic fields. And what we did here was we created the antihydrogen atom in the magnetic trap so that if it was cold enough or moving slowly enough, it didn't escape this magnetic bottle.
Hmm. And how many atoms were you able to capture?
Well, in this article, we reported 38 as a proof of principle. This was the first signal that we saw. So, of course, we report the signal as soon as it comes because we've been working a long time to see anything at all.
Hmm.
So this is a proof of principle experiment, but we're making steady progress since then.
Now, what is the difference between antihydrogen and the real or the regular hydrogen we see around us?
That's exactly the question that we'd like to answer. The laws of physics say that hydrogen and antihydrogen should behave in the same way. The problem is that nature chose to only give us matter. You know, people think at the Big Bang there were equal quantities of matter and antimatter, but for some reason the antimatter disappeared. It's like nature took a left turn instead of a right turn and chose matter. So we don't know what happened to the antimatter. So we'd like to study and see if there's some fundamental difference between the two that the current laws of physics have overlooked.
Hmm. And you were able to capture it for 1 second. Is that, and you say this is a proof of concept, does that mean that theoretically you can capture it for a longer amount of time?
Not just theoretically. The antimatter didn't escape in this experiment. We threw it out. The way we show that we've trapped it is to first trap it and then release it intentionally. The thing about antimatter is that when it meets matter, it annihilates. It makes a little microscopic explosion that we're very good at detecting. So the way that you show that you've trapped antihydrogen is to intentionally let it go at a given time. So the time that we stored the antimatter for in the experiment was by choice, not by some limit. We've already succeeded in storing it for much, much longer times.
How much longer?
I can't tell you. Because
you have to shoot me.
It's not like that. It's just we don't quote published numbers. But I usually say it's a number you could measure with a watch.
Oh,
okay.
And when you say, well, isn't there, we always see in the movies and we hear, you know, what happens when antimatter annihilates with matter. There's this huge explosion. Wasn't there a huge explosion or danger of one?
On the microscopic level, it's a huge explosion. But the amount of energy from a few atoms is completely negligible. In fact, the total amount of antimatter produced at CERN in all of its history would barely boil your coffee. Right? So for us, it's easy to detect, but it's of absolutely no danger to anyone, anywhere. I usually say it would take longer than the age of the universe to create just 1 gram of antimatter. So you don't need to worry about that.
Yeah. And now what practical value comes out of this work?
Absolutely none. This is basic research at the most fundamental level. We're asking about what's the structure of space and time. Can we learn something about what we usually refer to as symmetry in nature? Is there a difference between left and right? What happens if time runs backwards? Is there a difference between matter and antimatter? You can actually get paid for trying to answer those questions.
And we think you should, actually.
Yeah.
Because not everything has to have a, you know, discernible. Who knows, somewhere down the line there might be, you know, was it Star Trek where they have antimatter running in their engines there?
Yeah, that's true. I don't know where they found that, but if you found some antimatter, okay, first you should keep it at a safe distance, but then you could consider it as an energy source. The problem is that if you try to make antimatter in the laboratory, it requires much, much more energy than you would ever get out of it. It's a complete loser as an energy source. So that's really science fiction.
Hmm. But it's also kind of science fiction-y, but fact, to think that if there was equal amounts of matter and antimatter at the Big Bang, where did it all go?
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure that our experiment will ever address that question. We're interested more in, do the laws of physics apply in the same way to matter and antimatter? There are other experiments at CERN that are trying to address that question more directly. Those are at the LHC. Our experiment doesn't use the LHC in any way, in contrary to what you see in the Dan Brown films and movies. We work at a low-energy accelerator. In fact, CERN has the only accelerator in the world that works in reverse. We actually slow the antiprotons down. We need to have them at very low energy, very cold, in order to make them and hold on to them.
And how did you actually make this antimatter?
Very slowly. What you do is you take the components of the antihydrogen atom. Okay, we start with hydrogen because that's the simplest atom. Everybody remembers it from high school, hopefully. It has a proton in the nucleus with a positive charge and an electron negatively charged orbiting around it. That's the normal atom cartoon that we all see.
Right.
So antihydrogen is identical but opposite. So the antiproton has a negative charge and is in the center of the atom, and the positron, or anti-electron, is the thing doing the orbiting. We're at CERN because they provide us with antiprotons. You have to make those in an accelerator. And this is where Mr. Einstein comes in, E equals mc squared. What CERN does is use E, energy, to make M, mass, right?
Right.
So we use energy to produce mass. And here's the curious thing. When you do that, you always make equal amounts of matter and antimatter. In the laboratory, if you produce an antiproton, you produce a proton at the same time. That seems to be a fundamental law, and that's why we're confused about the beginning of the universe. So we make this stuff within a big accelerator and then slow it down. We want it at really cold temperatures when we combine antiprotons and positrons to make antihydrogen atoms.
Quite fascinating. And so then you sort of recycle it when you're done with it by getting rid of it. And so this could have been done years ago, do you think, or just people waiting?
No. We've been working on this steadily since the history of the field goes to the late 80s, and there's been no pause or let up in the attempt to get this far. The last big breakthrough was in 2002. It's another experiment that we had called Athena, where we actually produced a lot of antihydrogen atoms for the first time. So we've been producing them for the last 8 years. It's only now that we've learned how to hold on to them so they don't run off and annihilate.
So you caught lightning in a bottle.
That's a good way to look at it, yes.
Yeah. Well, we want to wish you good luck.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for taking time to be with us.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
And
thank you for your interest.
Yeah, because we're very interested in this topic, and we'll check in with you when research continues.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
We were talking about antimatter being caught in a bottle at CERN with Jeffrey Hengst, professor in the Department of Astronomy and Physics at Aarhus University in Denmark, but he was in Switzerland when we were talking about him.